From NPR News, I'm Tony Cox. On today's show, after 3 decades of advocating for women's rights and helping to plant more than 30 million trees across Africa, 2004 Nobel Peace Prize winner Dr. Wangari Maathai joins us to talk about the future of that continent, the changing culture of African women, and how the environment plays a key role. Also, they're green, and they're one of the hottest dishes around. Correspondent Leonita Inge gets into the holiday spirit with a celebration of collard greens. And finally, what's your favorite old-school Christmas tune? Get your ears ready as we listen in with a couple of veteran DJs who take us on a Yuletide tour, R&B style. That's a little later. But first, gone are the days of the international aid workers moving seamlessly from country to country, culture to culture. The recent murder of CARE International's Margaret Hassan highlights an alarming trend that, though it has been developing for years, seems to have accelerated with the attacks of 9/11 and the current war in Iraq. However, the current hostile climate is not particular to Iraq or Afghanistan. Yesterday, Save the Children UK announced it will be withdrawing from Darfur, Sudan, after 2 members of its staff were pulled from their car and executed. In a moment, we'll discuss some of the broader issues facing today's aid workers when we are joined by representatives from Doctors Without Borders, a French nonprofit and leading provider of international emergency health care, and Interaction, the largest alliance of U.S.-based international development and humanitarian non-governmental organizations. But to first help us understand the stress of life in the trenches, we spoke with Krista Ridley, Deputy Director of Policy and Advocacy for Oxfam America. She has experienced firsthand the humanitarian crisis in the Darfur area of Sudan.
You're trying to provide aid to these thousands upon thousands of people who are begging for your assistance. You're not always able to provide everything they need. You're seeing situations where there are malnourished children, where, you know, women have gone out to collect firewood and have been attacked or raped. Hearing their stories and seeing the sad situation in front of you is definitely very stressful and painful. On the other hand, I think that sometimes you get into a routine where you're just doing the work and doing the work and doing the work, and you don't have time to think about how harsh and difficult and painful it is. And until you actually go out of that situation and take a break and really decompress, you don't feel it fully.
Here to dig deeper into the issues are Mary McClymont, CEO of Interaction, and Katrine Schultehillen, the U.S. Program Director for Doctors Without Borders. Mary, Katrine, welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Tony.
Mary, let's start with you. Through Interaction, you have your fingertips on the pulse of the humanitarian community. We've already heard about the Sudan. We know about Afghanistan, Zimbabwe, Iraq. Tell us, how bad is the situation, and how much does location matter with regard to the danger?
Well, Tony, I think you need to recognize that humanitarian relief work is just inherently dangerous. There's lots of brave people in the field working in and around conflict. They're unarmed. They're helping suffering people get life-saving assistance, and unfortunately, violence isn't new to them. The data we've seen, and there isn't very much on it, doesn't clearly draw comparisons or suggest trend lines, but certainly in the last couple of years, there appears to be a clear rise in fatal attacks, most prominently in, of course, Afghanistan and Iraq. One study shows more fatal attacks in 2003 than in previous years, and well over half of them were in Afghanistan and Iraq. So I think that although there is great violence in a number of places around the world, that is predominantly where it has occurred in the last couple of years at least.
Katrine, Doctors Without Borders has actually withdrawn all of its staff from Iraq and from Afghanistan. Is that permanent, do you think, and what will it take for you to return?
Well, I think we have to look at the reasons behind, and Mary pointed out some of, you know, the trend that we've seen over the last years. I think the combination that we have in Afghanistan and Iraq is a very dangerous environment for humanitarian aid workers and a very difficult environment to actually do effective aid in the areas of most need. So what you see is that the withdrawal at this moment combines a logic of those two, that we haven't been in Afghanistan being able to go into the areas of most need because of the danger, and we have had direct attacks with five members of our organization being killed. So I think in the future to assess if we would go back into the situation, we have to look at the needs among the population and the possibility to address those needs. if tomorrow there is an epidemic outbreak, obviously we're going to re-examine the situation, make new new assessments on the security situation and on our capacity to distinguish ourselves as a humanitarian aid worker and not be associated to the political agenda.
Well, we know that these are dangerous places, Mary, but there has been criticism of foreign aid workers, which has stepped up in recent years, some of it coming from workers being accused of living high off the hog, as they say, in places like Afghanistan, while the local population lives hand to mouth. How valid is this criticism?
Well, Tony, what I think we have to remember is these situations are often complicated. There's a lot of people out there who are working in a place, say, like Afghanistan. It's a complex mix of people. It's private, for-profit contractors. It's foreign business people. It's military people, sometimes dressed in civilian clothing, which has caused us a lot of concern, especially if they're carrying guns. But bearing that in mind, it's therefore not always the non-governmental organizations that are doing this sort of thing. I think it's important for the non-governmental organizations in the sense that they have to work very closely with people on the ground. Our work is all about building trust. So we're particularly sensitive to cultural concerns and to living in the right way. We have very diverse staffs. Often the non-governmental organizations employ local staff people. They hire local people, people who know the culture. And happily, that also helps give people employment opportunities. So I think we do our best in trying to stay professional and trying to stay accountable and trying to work closely with the people whose trust we really need to have in the local communities.
I want to pursue this a little bit more. I'm going to bring you in on this, Katrine, to ask you about the workers a little more in detail. Who is willing to go these days, given the danger that is occurring and the lives that are lost? Do you have, for example, a different class of volunteer, if I can put it that way, and is that a part of the problem at all?
No, I wouldn't see that as an issue at all. I wouldn't see that at all. The choice to go into a context is not an individual choice of a person. The organization makes the decision to be in a context or to withdraw for security reasons. And it's not a volunteer that says, I want to go to this context. We look at the profile of the person and then propose a context for them. So I don't think it has to do with the profile of the people. If that responds to your question, I hope I understood your question.
Yeah, I think you did. Mary, do you agree with that assessment?
Well, I think, Tony, it's as I said before, I think what you see with non-governmental organizations is they're really attempting to diversify their staffs, hire people who are local, hire people who know the culture, not necessarily always Westerners or Americans or Brits. And that's a very important feature. I also think that many of the non-governmental organizations, certainly the members of Interaction, are trying to professionalize their work more and more. They're trying to hold themselves accountable. They're trying to be accountable to the local populations that they work with and serve. And one way we do that is to use standards that help guide our performance. So I really do think there is an attempt by many of us in the non-governmental organizational community to do a better job at professionalizing.
What about, let me follow this with you, Mary, what about the complaint from some quarters that the American military has intentionally blurred the lines that once differentiated, combatants from aid workers? What are we talking about here?
Well, Tony, it's very complicated and frankly dangerous in some of these crises where necessarily humanitarians must work in the same areas as military people, whether they're government or rebels. And what we're urging our government, our military, and all militaries that we would work with is to keep a separation between our functions. Let the humanitarians undertake the critical humanitarian assistance work and let the military do the very, very crucial work of security. That would then help avoid any blurring of lines so that humanitarians who try to be impartial and independent would not then be seen as an arm of a government or a party to the conflict. We need access to local populations. We don't want to become targets, and we're more necessarily going to become targets if we're associated with a military group. Lately or earlier in Afghanistan, we were concerned when soldiers were wearing civilian clothing and carrying guns, even while they were delivering humanitarian aid. And that really leads to confusion and insecurity. So what we're urging is people do what they best do, where their competencies lie. We need the critical military to do the security, and we really need and have the experience to do the humanitarian aid delivery.
It certainly is an evolving situation, and I would like to get both of you to close the conversation by addressing this issue. What does the future mean? do you think of humanitarian relief look like, Katrine?
Well, I think we're looking at important challenges, and one of the key ones is the one that that Mary pointed out, of the roles of the different actors, the multiplication of actors in the different fields of humanitarian aid, and what I would call the erosion of the respect for the provisions that have been made under the Geneva Conventions. If we look about humanitarian aid in its initial conception, which is an aid which is given to civil population who are living in a conflict situation, so this space for humanity within conflict, the necessity to adhere to certain principles of action, both for state actors, non-state actors, and aid organization is crucial. And at this time, I think especially over the last 2 years, what we've been seeing is an erosion of the respect for those principles for all parties involved. That means for the coalition forces, for non-state actors, however we want to call them, and for organizations themselves to adhere to principles of neutrality, independence, and impartiality. And I think we all have to be... Well,
let me jump in. I want to give Mary an opportunity to respond. Yes. We've only got about 30 seconds or so left. Mary, what do you see for the future?
Well, Tony, necessarily the extremist groups who are out there operating make it immensely difficult and deadly. They seek chaos and destabilization, completely contrary to what humanitarians and others seek. But I think in addition, it is critical that we do as Katrine suggested. It's also very important for us all to improve on our own security measures. It's very important for us to help other governments and various parties in these conflicts
to understand these humanitarian
values.
I apologize.
Sorry.
Our time is up. Mary McClymont, CEO of Interaction, the largest alliance of U.S.-based international development and humanitarian non-governmental organizations, and Katrine Schulte-Hillen, U.S. Program Director for Doctors Without Borders. Thanks again.